This is Tim.
Hi, this is Peter Maruska from Sunday Press.
And this is Deconstructing Comics. Welcome to Deconstructing Comics. This is Tim in Tokyo, and I'm talking to Peter Maruska from Sunday Press in Palo Alto, California. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Oh, my pleasure.
We're going to talk today about Little Nemo, the Winsor McCay's comic strip from starting in 1905.
Right.
I asked Peter to come on because at Sunday Press he published a collection of Little Nemo, and it was the actual size, right? 16 by 21 inches?
Right, within 2% here and there. The various papers changed it a little bit over the years, but we settled in on what was pretty much the full size. It was the way they were printed.
I see. And so this came out in 2005, and I understand that's when this went into public domain.
Yeah, the book came out just about a month before the actual printing of the book. Different parts went into public domain at different times. Because what happened is that McKay himself had bought the rights back, or had been given the rights for a dollar for the strip. So I think everything went into public domain in about 2006 or 2007.
Okay. So there have been several different editions come out. What I've got is the first volume of Checker Press's series. And I think Fantagraphics had put some out also.
At some point. Fantagraphics had put out a complete series, and then Checker, I think, put them all out in two volumes. But the problem with these is, it's aside from not being able to appreciate them, the early ones in particular were very hard to read because everything there was so much detail, and the print was so small. And I'd had a collection of these that I've been building up for the last 30 years, and I'd seen my collection just start to deteriorate year after year, and realizing that there's going to be a time where these things would be gone forever. And it's recognized as the greatest comic strip there ever was, and most people in the world had never seen it the way it was actually printed, or they had seen very few actual newspaper pages. So the idea was to give people a chance to experience it the way it was 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, having read Checker's version, which is maybe about two-thirds actual size-ish. You know, sometimes,
a little less.
Sometimes yeah. the lettering is pretty tiny to try to read.
Yeah.
But the thing
coloring
is
kind of all over the place, so I tried to get the standardized color as well.
I see. The thing is, it seems like it's hard to put out a version that's... they tend to get a little pricey. I think it's just maybe just because of the size. Even like Checker's version is $50, and yours went over that for I think, you know, justifiable reasons. But still, I think it's hard to maybe get anyone interested in it outside of like people who already were really into it.
Right. Well, hopefully these things get shared, too. I've done what I can to give breaks to libraries to see that these things can be in their special collections in libraries so that people can go to libraries and read them.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what did it actually involve to find the artwork and the original pages and clean it up and publish it?
Well, I have the full collection myself. In a couple of cases, I went to other people that I knew had some better versions. The Nemo's home paper, the Herald, had the best printing jobs. In fact, McKay used to go down late at night to the printing presses and actually work with them to get the colors right and get the separations right. And so that had the best printing. So the idea was to find as many of those pages as I could that I didn't have in my own collection. And then they were scanned in two pieces and put back together. And a lot of them had holes, or they had stains or tears, things that read the ravages of time. So I cleaned those up as much as possible. Sometimes out of register color or ink smudges or imperfections in the paper that were a natural part of the reading experience, I left all that stuff in.
I see. Okay. I wanted to establish a little context for the strip. Now this is only about 10 years after The Yellow Kid, which is considered kind of the first modern comic strip.
Right.
Now, what was the kind of state of comic strips at this stage, especially in terms of the popularity, and were there a lot of them, and how were they appearing?
Well, they were appearing. It turns out that just about every newspaper, in order to compete, had to have a color comic section. Except, of course, the New York Times. And the rumor there was that if they couldn't have Little Nemo, they weren't going to have any comic strips. I don't know if that's apocryphal or Ox actually said that, but yeah, when the big battle was between at the time Hearst and Pulitzer, who were going back and forth with their color comic sections. The four color presses had actually first been put to use by Pulitzer, whose idea was to bring the great works of art to the masses in full color every Sunday. And turned out the great works of art, when put through this process, looked like crap, but really did work. They had all of these sort of line drawings that were being done for political cartoons and social satire and so forth in their Sunday comic sections, and sometimes dailies as well. So they applied that to those comic strips, and it just took off. It was a huge success, and that was the beginnings of the Yellow Kid and the Cats and Jammer Kids, and then a series of one-shots and numerous different types of characters that would appear in Pulitzer's World Paper in New York.
Mm-hmm. And most of these were not syndicated, right? They're just at one paper.
Well. After the first couple of years, when other newspapers realized what a good selling point this is, syndication started pretty early, particularly with the Hearst papers. Mm. So they were syndicated, by the turn of the century. All of the Hearst papers were showing up. The Hearst stable of comics: Cats and Jammer Kids, Happy Hooligan, Swinnerton, Buster Brown. But still, at that time, a lot of the major newspaper markets, Chicago and St. Louis, Philadelphia, had their own comic strips with minimal syndication here and there going on. Once Little Nemo came out, there were a lot of newspapers that did want to have this in their papers. So the Herald, which had been doing some minimal syndication up to this point, by 1905, really had probably 1906, really had a greater syndication going on with these comics.
Okay, but now, was Nemo ever syndicated?
Yes, it was. It was the New York Herald. I guess you'd have to check with Rick Marshall or Bill Blackbeard, probably know a lot more about the politics of this, but there was a Chicago Herald and a New York Herald, and they were associated either by the same owner or closely associated. But there are other newspapers in Los Angeles and St. Louis and San Francisco and Detroit that picked up Little Nemo through a syndication, an early syndication process.
I see. Now, reading the strip itself, well, I guess, as I understand it, the other strips that he did besides Nemo tended to be very formulaic. Checker's edition includes a lot of pages of the Jungle Imps comic also, which are so formulaic that I kind of gave up on them after a while and skipped ahead to the Nemo stuff.
Well, it was done that way because that was most... Children's stories were very much like that. When they put out editions, they'd have a certain formula that they would use and bring the characters back to tell different types of stories using that same formula. And that was the Jungle Imps formula, was that here's how something got created. And the Sammy Sneeze idea, where it's just one sneeze and would tear down a building. And Little Nemo itself is formulaic in the sense that particularly the early ones, each one would start out where he was in bed, and he'd be taken away off into slumberland, and then the final panel, he'd wake up and fall out of bed. And that stayed through, at least the final panel concept stayed through all the way through the entire series. Mm-hmm. And the Cats and Jammer Kids were very formulaic as well. Mm-hmm. As people liked that sort of, well, they still do. A lot of sitcoms have the same formula every week. So.
Yeah, that's true. Although I think you could say in Nemo, he would sort of periodically change the formula and follow a different formula.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's why I say after the first 9 or 10 months or so, it would the only thing they'd all have in common would be that final wake-up panel.
Yeah, it's at the beginning he's like trying to get the Slumberland to and the princess wants him to be her playmate, and then he wakes up, and then the next strip he's kind of starting from scratch again. But then it's nice. It starts to open up when it gets so that his dreams will continue in the next strip rather than starting over.
Right, and that started probably in after about 2 months. It became more of a continued story. In fact, depending on who you talk to, it really was the, if not the first, one of the first in the Sunday comics that had a continued adventure.
I see. But yeah, it really opens up the possibilities when he starts serializing it rather than starting over every time.
Right. You can really tell a great story, particularly in the 1910 episode where he goes to Mars and they get the entire Martian society. It's a social satire on a lot of the things that were happening in the United States at the time.
Oh, wow. I found it interesting to watch the evolution of how he's telling the story, because at the beginning he's really relying on narration and in addition to the word balloons, and then eventually that just kind of fades out.
Yeah, that's kind of a carryover from the children's illustrated books, the turn of the century, and a lot of the early comic strips were done in narration only with illustration. The Oz comics, a book that I just came out with this year, the Queer Visitors from the Marvelous Land of Oz, that was done, interestingly enough, with an entire text that was written by L. Frank Baum and images in panel form. Captions under the images and balloons as well, so there are all three combined in that strip. So they were making use of all the different formats at the time until they settled it to essentially just the balloons with occasional narration.
Yeah, well, now is that an innovation of McKay, or who was the
No,
first to
no.
get rid of narration?
The well, the yellow kid had balloons right off the bat, as did Katzenjammer Kids. A lot of them had a combination. A lot of the stuff that was the sort of classic fantasy for children was essentially narration. But it they bounced back and forth until about, well, Nemo in the last part of 1906 got away with the narration altogether, and by that time, most strips, well, by about 1910, most strips dropped the narration and went to all balloons.
I see. Now, eventually he does finally get to meet the princess, and we have some goings on in the court in Slumberland, and then he meets Flip, and that's a really important point when Flip enters it, because Flip starts out as really his enemy.
Right. Flip is the one who prevents his dreams from continuing and brings on the sun and forces him to wake up. So it's really sort of the bad guy in the idea of dreams. But they eventually become pretty close, and there's sort of a between Impy and Flip and Nemo, sort of a combination between the Three Musketeers and the Three Marx Brothers as they go out on their adventures.
Yeah, that makes sense. And Flip, I was trying to figure out what race he's supposed to be, because he seems to be green, at least in the Checker edition.
Yeah, I don't think that there's a specific race involved. He is, yeah, he's green throughout, and that's what he actually has sort of a green paint face, and it's not his skin color. The back of his head is pink, and his hands and feet are pink. So for some reason, he has sort of like a clown makeup,
I see.
and that's just to add the hue to the humanness of it. The humor of the character.
And then apparently he's supposed to be a child, but he's always got a cigar in his mouth.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I think he's a child in stature and in emotional maturity, but he really is an adult.
Yeah. In this these strips that I've read, the first Checker volume, I think my favorite was the one where I believe it's Nemo and Flip and Impy are like really hungry, and they end up eating the masthead,
Right.
breaking out of the frame. And oh, these letters are actually floating above us. Let's eat them.
Yeah, so they actually rip apart the panels to use as tools to knock down the letters to have something to eat. And it had been done a few times before in comics, but it was one of the few early times where they actually sort of stepped through that fourth wall and made fun of the medium itself, and made use of the medium itself.
Yeah. You have any particular favorite Nemo strip?
Oh gosh, it's hard to say. I think it goes back and forth. It's like, you know, what's your favorite movie or what's your favorite song? It depends on what you looked at last. There's so many great ones. I really do enjoy that the story where they go to Mars, where the idea is that Mars has become so overpopulated and incredibly polluted and politically and socially corrupt, where there's one man who actually owns not only all of the real estate, but also owns all of the water, all of the air, and all of the words. Mm. If that's by words, if you want to, if you want to have a chance to say anything, all the words are different prices. You know, cuss words are only sold to adults. And as they travel through this Martian society, they see the overpopulation, huge people cramming on these vehicles to commute. They see the extreme pollution, where it's difficult to breathe, and you're actually you can actually swim in the air because it's so thick in pollutants, and you have to always be grabbing oxygen. So it was really a little bit ahead of its time in the idea of showing the dangers very commercial and overpopulated society.
Yeah, that sounds like something that might have come out in the 1960s or later.
Yeah.
Now, the art is really, I think, the feature, and you could argue, more than the story, because the art is really beautiful, and he draws a lot of animals.
Yeah, it's so outstanding, well. And he's such an amazing draftsman. That to be able to, like you say, draw incredible animals, both real animals like elephants and imagined animals like dinosaurs and dragons, but at the same time have this incredible ability to draw the most complex architecture, you know, magnificent buildings and huge landscapes and complex machinery. And there was a fellow that had actually worked with him, that I spoke with many years ago, who was down in Florida, who said that McKay never used a straight edge, never used a French curve or compass or anything. The only thing, occasionally he would draw straight lines for the panels. Mm-hmm. But all of the stuff he did interior, the straight lines and the curves and all the complex architectural buildings and cross-hatchings and things were all done freehand.
Wow.
And that's one thing that I realized when I started restoring the strips, because many times I would have to blow them up 10 or 15 times to try and repair little bits. And you really get to see every little brush stroke and every little ink line drawing, and just amazing what he was able to do, and to do very quickly as well. At the same time he was drawing the strip, he was also in around 1910, 1911, he had a Broadway show where he was a quick draw artist, where people would call things out from the audience, and he would draw characters on a big pad.
Mm, yeah, and I understand there was also a stage version of Nemo going on at the same time.
Right. Well, that was done in although he didn't have any direct involvement in that. Mm. That was, I believe, in 1906, and it was a really very big success.
I was going to comment the art. One thing that I notice is seldom does he really represent motion. Things that are supposed to be moving very quickly seem to be sitting still in most cases. Like, I think there's one where there's a toboggan going downhill, but you don't see any motion lines or anything.
Yeah, he would do things would be really freeze framed, even if like ocean waves would be frozen. But that's not to say that it was. Wasn't that it didn't have movement and wasn't cinematic. There, he was able to get, I think, a sense of movement, and even in those freeze frames that he used. On a similar topic, he experimented in a lot of techniques of cinema that really hadn't even been thought of at the time, and also with sound. And sound, of course, hadn't been in cinema at the time, the small amount of cinema that there is. Example of this is, it can be seen a couple of times in the Martian sequence in particular, where he would use what would be like a deep focus shot or a rack focus, the term in cinema, where you would start in one plane and Nemo would move toward what would be the camera. And as he would move toward the camera, the characters in the back, who were in a deep fog, would become fuzzy. Not only would they become fuzzy, but the balloons were outlined in gray, and Nemo's outlines were outlined in white. So as you sort of back off and your image is muted and your text is muted, he would reflect that in the artwork. And as Nemo got forward, the other characters would disappear completely into the background. And another character would come out of the background. This is a villain who was about to kidnap Nemo. And he would be slightly blurred, and his text balloon would be grayed out to show that his voice was muted. And as he got into the foreground to grab Nemo, everything would be sharp and clear, and all the balloons would be black against white. So there's some, you know, cinematic techniques that were used, techniques to mimic changes in sound. And demonstrated McKay's interest in cinema that later came out in his animated films.
I haven't seen those later strips, but it sounds like he had developed somewhat since the ones that I've read, where most of the scenes are all from, like, the same viewpoint. It's like more like watching a stage play. There aren't like different camera angles or zooms or anything.
Well, actually, as early as 1906, there were several shots that were large panoramas. That was where Nemo would be in the close up, and they would have a high camera angle looking at the background. And one of the tricks that he used even early on, even 1905 and 1906. Would be when there was a far-off background, in order to sort of make the background fade, the color, the detail would be outlined in a color rather than black and white. So it wouldn't be crisp and clear. Like if you go to the Grand Canyon, you don't see sharp detail in the really distant rocks. It's all sort of becomes faded and muted and blurry. So he would use this trick several times to give the foreground sharp detail by outlining it in black and give the background more of a faded look without having any black outline. Very famous page where he's flying on the back of a bird, and the angle is from above Nemo and the bird, and looking down into a huge landscape below that is all in sort of dark colors without any sharp black outlines, and the Nemo and the bird in the foreground sharply outlined in black. So he started experimenting with lots of different ways to show depth and to show perspective that were never used at all in comics before.
Mm-hmm.
And even as you say, like a lot of it is like you're looking at a stage play, but one very famous set where you are remaining as the audience with a frozen vision on the characters, the background begins to grow and fade where buildings appear in the background where there were none, and the buildings come closer and closer and closer. Until our characters are sitting right in the middle of the courtyard of the buildings. And they aren't moving, the stage isn't moving, but it's like the backdrop of the stage is coming forward while you're sitting in one place in the audience. Mm-hmm. So even when he works with stage, he's doing movements and tricks that couldn't be done in a regular stage.
Mm, yeah, I see. Now, some of the dreams that Nemo has are pretty scary. I mean, I'm not sure if I read this as a little kid, I'm not sure that I would want to keep reading.
Oh yeah, particularly in the early stages where he would meet characters and try and get interested in characters, so all of a sudden they turn to stone and they turn to china and crumble, and he'd be totally freaked out. And in fact, the first 6 months, most of the strips ended where some horribly frightening thing would be happening just before the last panel, just before he would wake up being tossed out of bed or being comforted with his mom. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of sort of nightmarish fear things going on, particularly from Nemo's point of view, if not the reader's as well.
I'm wondering what was going on in McKay's mind, or why he was presenting those kinds of things.
Yeah, there's been a lot written about McKay and dreams and relationship with ideas floating around the same time with Sigmund Freud and others. I don't really know. I just think he was really in touch with what it was like to be a child and to have dreams. And I can remember dreams that I had that were both fascinating and horribly frightening at the same time as a child. And I think he really tapped into that well.
Now, the I couldn't help noticing the word balloons as I was reading this, because they read as if he just sort of left a space for the words before he decided what he was going to write.
Yeah, there's a lot of different theories on what was going on, that he would have the balloon thinking of a certain amount of words he wanted to say, and then sort of run out of space and have to run up the side of the, mm-hmm. of the balloon with it. So, yeah, I don't know how much of that was planned and how much was errors. He probably didn't script the text a lot ahead of time, and it was just added afterwards. One of the things I was really pleased with the French editions of my full size Nemo books is that they really, rather than just having a computerized font, which is what a lot of foreign translations of things would do, they got a really good draftsman to copy McKay's writing style in French, even in the changing the size of the text, going up the sides of the balloons and so on. And, I was really pleased that they took the extra time, and they understood that that really is part of the comic strip itself. That's part of the style of McKay.
Mm-hmm. And the placement of the balloons, sometimes it's hard to follow the order of the conversations, because he's not really like placing them in a like left to right order necessarily.
Yeah, and again, I think that has to do with the importance of the art above all else. And the balloons were put into place where they didn't, you could get away with not having an important statement being made by the art. But for the most part, it doesn't really matter if things are being sort of stated at the same time or figuring out who's responding what to whom. They leave that to the audience to actually the precise sequence in line.
Now, in 1911, McKay moved to a different newspaper.
There were a lot of stories about William Randolph Hearst and how he would go around just sort of buying whatever talent he wanted and bring it over to his paper, and he would go raid the newsrooms of other newspapers. This was seen in Citizen Kane. I guess there was some truth to that. There certainly was some truth of it in the story of Winsor McKay, where Hearst told McKay that he was wasting his time over there, and that Hearst would give him some real money and be able to do whatever he wanted to. So he, in 1911, he left, and there was a very brief period where there was no Little Nemo, but the Herald still owned the trademark Little Nemo in Slumberland. So when he moved over to the Hearst papers, it was called In the Wonderful Land of Dreams. And a lot of people say that they don't that there was a lot less imagination in this period, and to some extent that's true. But it may be because McKay was at the time was getting interested in doing animated films as well. He was also very quickly felt that he was kind of trapped by Hearst, and Hearst would in fact made him quit his Broadway show, and it didn't allow him to go moonlighting and doing his nightly shows as a quick draw artist in vaudeville routines. And he also demanded that he started doing more editorial cartoons. This is what Hearst really wanted him to do, because he felt McKay's power as an artist could really help get Hearst's kind of message across. Hearst really had an idea that he knew what was right for America and really wanted to get this message across, and the fantastic artwork of McKay was going to be this tool that he was going to use. And so the pages were really sort of erratic, the quality of the pages during this period.
Have any of those been republished?
All of those, that period was done in the Fantagraphics series. In the second volume that I did of the Little Nemo Splendid Sundays, we did sort of the best of that period in full-size form, the period while he was at the Hearst papers. And after that, he continued to do stuff for Hearst in the teens. And in the 1920s, there was new leadership over at the Herald, and they brought him back to do. Hearst got the public was sort of losing interest in Little Nemo. It was never a huge public success, and it was a critical success, but it didn't have the same sort of comic clout that Cats and Jammer Kids did and other things in the teens. So Hearst had less and less interest. Little Nemo was dropped to like two color and black and white pages, and sort of very lame, uninteresting stories were coming through. There's this little social commentary and things about cruelty to animals, and you know, the whole fantasy Slumberland stuff had fallen away. But in the 20s, the people at the Herald brought him back, and he got back to the idea of the fantasy stories. And there were some really great stories done in that period from 1924 to early 1927, but for the most part never really reached the heights that it had in the early days at the Herald.
Mm-hmm. I see. And I guess those later ones are not yet public domain.
No, they are in public domain as well. Many of them have been reprinted in the second volume from Sunday Press, The Splendid Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we took the best of that period.
I see.
And reprinted that, so you get the whole mix of the three different eras of Nemo.
Now, I wanted to bring up the Jungle Imps. Because obviously it was a much different time than now, but you know, to the modern viewer, those characters look like a pretty racist take on black people. But I wonder what McKay's mindset was about black people. If you know, he consciously didn't like them, or if it was just kind of the way that you were supposed to portray them then.
Well, some and some none. The characters, the Jungle Imps, were not racist in the same sense that that a lot of other comics were, where the black Americans were lazy if they weren't uppity. They hung around, ate watermelon, they gambled, they stole chickens, they were drunk. A lot of this stuff sort of thing appeared, and blacks in their finest moments in early comics were as benevolent servants to the rich white folks. But McKay's black character, Impey and others, were not. I mean, he was a jungle native, and he might as well have been a Samoan as an African. And the whole idea of an interesting jungle savage, maybe it's a pygmy, maybe it's something else, was sort of humorous and at the same time foreign and exotic and exciting. So we'll look at it as a typical racist caricature of blacks in America, but at that time it really wasn't. It was a caricature of some far off characters that had been seen in pictures and stories, but no one in America really ever experienced anything like a Jungle Imp.
Yeah,
but yeah, there were a lot of other comics that you don't really see reprinted that really had really horribly racist overtones to them, and that went on to some extent right up through the 1950s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you watch some of the early Disney cartoons too, you really see it.
Sure, Disney cartoons and Max Fleischer cartoons and Warner Brothers cartoons. There was Cole Black and the Seven Sebbian Dwarfs that was all done in black characters, and that was sort of the minstrel show. It was the jazz singer sort of routine where blacks were great when they were sort of entertaining, and we could sort of make fun of their blackness as we entertained. And so and they felt that wasn't being in any way savage or cruel. That was just blacks are good as entertainers.
Yeah. Now you mentioned L. Frank Baum earlier in Oz books. Are you aware? Did Baum and McKay ever have any contact?
I doubt it. I'm sure that that Baum was aware of McKay's work, and I'm sure that they might have seen each other's stuff. But the Baum comic strip came out before Little Nemo, so he may have seen some of McKay's stuff earlier in the Midwest, but it could be that, well, because he was in Chicago, and Chicago printed some of McKay's early things. So, but I don't think it was anything more than just as part of the general background of comic strips that were appearing in the newspaper. And when Bob was coming out with his second book, his sequel, he was a pretty savvy businessman. And he decided this would be a great way to promote his new book, to get all of these people reading about it in newspapers across the country, reading about his characters and learning about his upcoming book.
What influence has, this might take a whole podcast in itself, but what influence has McKay had on subsequent comics creators?
Yeah, direct and indirect, almost everyone. There's a lot of people who will acknowledge that that Winsor McKay had a lot to do with them getting into comic strips and doing the types of comics and drawing comics the way they have. Modern people like Waterston Calvin and Hobbes and McDonald's Mutz. They'll both talk about how McKay influenced them directly. And Maurice Sendak, in many ways, is in The Night Kitchen, is an homage to the dreams of Little Nemo and the work of McKay.
Yeah. Where the wild things are.
Yeah, but a lot of people will use the French artist Mobius will acknowledge the influence that McKay had on his comic strips. But a lot of comic artists will use concepts that were developed by McKay long before they were seen later on in comics, and they were sort of picked up indirectly, where someone in the 30s and 40s might have picked up a trick off McKay, and that would influence comic artists in the 60s, who were then read by people in the 80s and 90s who picked up some of these techniques. So there's a lot of indirect influence. But yeah, there's probably more than any single comic artist McKay has influenced the medium.
Mm-hmm. What do you think are the most significant things about McKay's work in the long term?
I guess the fact that there was so much landmark stuff being done. When you look at his work in 1905 and 1906 and the comics that had come before that, it's almost nothing. There were people who were experimenting in ways to tell a story with panels. There are people who were experimenting in styles of artwork before that, but no one really brought it together the way McKay did in those early pages, and they really stand out, and they'll always stand out as a real high point, really a completely new paradigm in the medium of comics.
I mean, I haven't seen a lot of the strips from the first half of the 20th century, but I'm just wondering if his innovations caught on right away, or if it took a while for the rest of comics to sort of catch up with him.
Well, there were a lot of other things that comics had to could be copying at the time. So they were influenced by McKay, but because of what else was more popular, a lot of them were influenced by Katzenjammer Kids and Swinnerton and Buster Brown and these other things as well that were going on. So a lot of the artists drew from a lot of different sources at the time, but there were many in that period directly around Nemo. There were many copycats, different artists coming out with dream sequences and fantasy sequences in comics that were very similar to Nemo. And years afterwards, particularly by Frank King, who had many many comic strips in Gasoline Alley, and his own strip Bobby Make Believe that had was very similar and to McKay. And then in the Gasoline Alley strips, there were many Sundays where they would have dream sequences with the characters waking up at the end. And there are at least 20 or 25 comic strips that I know afterwards that copied this concept of starting out in a dream world and having the characters wake up at the end. Everything from Dixie Dugan to Little Annie Rooney to Nancy, all sorts of other comic strips later on copy this formula. Not on a regular basis, but specific Sundays they would do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, then eventually it sort of becomes homage to it instead of just picking up the technique.
Oh, sure. But a lot of times in the 1940s and 50s, kids reading this stuff had no idea what Little Nemo was, so they weren't able to say, oh yeah, this is McKay stuff, even though all the people who were drawing the comics and who were aware of the earlier comics picked up on it and said, oh yeah, he's doing a Little Nemo. We'll be right back.
check out the Sunday Press site at sundaypressbooks.com. And of course, our site is deconstructingcomics.com, where you'll find social network links, over a year's worth of past episodes, and more. Leave comments under any particular episode you liked or had questions about. If you're enjoying this podcast, help us build up our audience by posting a review at iTunes or other podcast sites like Odeo or Podcast Pickle. And remember, the address to send me any comments or questions is mail@deconstructingcomics.com. Coming up this Thursday, I'll be republishing episode 96 from October 2007, in which Brandon and I review Matt Kint's graphic novel Super Spy. Then, next week, our 200th episode, in which I interview two creators of historically themed comics, both of whom are based in St. Louis, a city where two rivers come together. The creators are, first of all, Matt Kint. Now you see why I'm republishing our review of Super Spy. He has several new books on the way, and he'll tell us about all of those. Then Tracy Butler of the webcomic Lackadaisy Cats, beautifully drawn story set in St. Louis during Prohibition. And, yes, all the characters are cats. It's published at lackadaisycats.com and is also now available as a book from Fourth Dimension Entertainment. St. Louis and historical comics, that's two themes for our 200th episode. Then you'll hear two regulars, Mulele and me, discussing some recent email we received. You won't want to miss it. Till then, thanks for listening. This is Tim. See you next week on Deconstructing Comics.